What's in a name? You know, it's that famous line from Shakespeare's Juliet
Right.
suggesting, you know, a rose, call it something else, it still smells sweet.
Uh-huh.
But was that really how ancient culture saw it? Was it just a label? Or did names maybe carry something, I don't know, deeper, maybe even a bit dangerous?
Well, that's a great question. And you're right. Ancient cultures, particularly in the biblical world, they took names way more seriously than Juliet seemed to, at least initially.
Yeah, you get the sense Romeo and Juliet found out pretty quick their names had some serious baggage attached.
They definitely did. It wasn't just semantics for them by the end.
Exactly. And that kind of depth, that weight, is what we're diving into today.
Okay.
This deep dive, we're really exploring that ancient understanding of names, and we're going to look at it through the lens of the third commandment. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain.
A really crucial one.
Yeah, and we're drawing heavily on Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino's teaching on the Ten Commandments. And I think, you know, it's really going to challenge some of our modern ideas about what a name even is.
It really does. Because what's so fascinating is how widespread this idea was that a name wasn't just like a handle you used to call someone.
Right.
It was seen as deeply, deeply connected to a person's their nature, their character, their identity, really.
So intrinsic identity, not just a tag.
Not just a tag at all.
Yeah.
It was fundamental to how they understood people.
Okay, so if names are identity, that completely changes how we read some of these biblical stories, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Let's maybe look at some examples where this really pops. Like, name changes seem pretty common.
Yeah, very common. And they weren't just like, getting a nickname or a rebrand.
No.
When someone entered a new significant relationship, especially like with a king or an emperor, an overlord,
Yeah.
they'd often get a new name.
Okay.
Think about Daniel and his friends in Babylon. They get Babylonian names.
Right. Belteshazzar and the others.
Exactly. Or you see kings getting new names when they become vassals to, say, the Syrian or Babylonian empires.
Yeah.
It signified a real shift, a change in who they were in relation to this new power.
Even if the meaning was similar sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. It was the act of giving the name, the new relationship it represented.
Like Abram to Abraham.
Perfect example. Abram means something like exalted father or, big daddy. Pretty respectable. But when God makes this covenant with him, he becomes Abraham. The meaning isn't drastically different, but God giving him that name, that marks this entirely new relationship, this covenant bond.
Seals the deal in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And then you've got Jacob. His name is connected to, well, to grasping, to taking something you're maybe not entitled to.
Bit of heel grabber.
Right. Grabs his twin Esau's heel at birth. And then later, the story, he cheats Esau out of his birthright. It's like his name foreshadows his actions, his character.
It's almost deterministic the way they viewed it.
It certainly feels that way sometimes in the text. The connection is incredibly strong.
Okay, to really nail this down, let's talk about Nabal and Abigail. This story seems pivotal.
Oh, absolutely. It's a fantastic illustration.
So David's on the run, needs supplies. Nabal, this rich guy, basically tells him to get lost.
Yep, completely dismissive and insulting, actually.
And David, he's furious. He's ready to wipe out Nabal and everyone associated with him.
He's seeing red, yeah.
But then Abigail, Nabal's wife, she steps in. She goes to David, pleads with him, and she says something amazing.
She does. She says, basically, "My lord, please just don't pay a whole lot of attention to my husband, Nabal.
Right.
His name is Nabal, and as a man's name is, so is he."
Wow. And Nabal means.
Nabal is the Hebrew word for fool.
So she's literally saying his name is fool, and guess what? He is a fool. Don't let this idiot ruin you.
That's exactly it. She's appealing to David's reason by pointing to her husband's very nature, encapsulated in his name.
And the irony is, Nabal dies almost immediately after this incident.
Right. God strikes him down, and Abigail, she ends up marrying David.
It just powerfully underlines that link. Name, nature, destiny, almost.
It really does.
So, okay, names aren't just identity. They're like an extension of the person. Is that the idea?
Yeah, that's a great way to put it, an extension. And that's why people were so protective of their names, especially, divine beings.
Because revealing it makes you vulnerable.
Exactly. It gives someone a kind of access, maybe even power, over you. Think about Jacob wrestling with that divine being all night.
The angel or.
Right. The text is a bit ambiguous, but as morning comes, Jacob demands, "Tell me your name."
And the being refuses.
Flat out. Says, "Why are you asking my name?" There's this immediate pushback, the sense that the name's too powerful, too sacred, too revealing to just hand over.
And we see something similar with Moses at the burning bush, right? God doesn't just immediately say, I'm Yahweh.
No, not right away. Moses asks, who should I say sent me? And God gives that really profound, somewhat evasive answer first. I am that which I am, or I will be what I will be.
Asher, Asher.
Right. It's powerful, but it's not the direct covenant name, Yahweh. That comes a bit later. It implies, I think, that once a name is revealed, especially a divine name,
it can be misused.
It can be misused. There's a vulnerability there, which brings us right back to the commandment.
Yes. The third commandment, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Let's break that down.
Okay. So first word, take. The Hebrew verb is nasa.
Nasa. What does that mean exactly?
Well, it's a really common verb. It can mean to lift up, to carry, to bear, but also to use, to employ, or even just to utter.
Okay, so a broad range. Does it imply doing something wrong with the name?
Not inherently, no. That's crucial. Nasa itself doesn't automatically mean abuse or misuse. The commandment isn't saying never say God's name. It's about how you nasa it, how you lift it up, how you carry it, how you use it.
The spirit and purpose behind it.
Precisely. It's about the manner of the using, not just the act of using.
Got it. Okay, so then the name of the Lord. What name are we talking about here?
Primarily, the focus is on Yahweh, that revealed personal covenant name of God.
The one that was so carefully guarded.
Exactly. Now, today, we often extend the principle to, you know, other words like God Elohim in Hebrew, or El, with the title Adonai, meaning Lord.
And that's why some Jewish traditions write G-E-D.
Yes. In some very conservative circles, that practice arose out of extreme caution, even in writing, to avoid any potential violation of the commandment's spirit regarding any designation for God.
Yeah.
But the primary reference point is Yahweh.
Okay. But there's another layer to name in Hebrew, isn't there?
Yes. And this is so important. The Hebrew word for name, Shem, doesn't just mean the label. It very often means reputation.
Reputation.
Yeah. So when you read the Psalms, for instance, and they say, praise the name of the Lord, or great is his name.
They're not just talking about the sound Yahweh.
Often, no. They're praising God's reputation, his character revealed through his actions, his nature, his faithfulness, his power. It's much bigger than just the word itself. It's about who God is and how he's known.
That makes so much sense. Okay, final piece. In vain. Hebrew shva.
Shva, yes. And this word means emptiness, nothingness, vanity, triviality, but also falsehood.
Emptiness, triviality, falsehood.
Right. It's actually thought to be related to our English word schwa. That unstressed, almost non-existent vowel sound.
Huh, like the A in about.
Exactly, very light, trivial. So in vain, lashva means using the name lightly, trivially, without proper weight or seriousness, or using it falsely, deceptively.
So while lots of modern translations say misuse, which is okay.
In vain really captures that original sense of emptiness, worthlessness, or falsehood better. Treating the sacred name as if it has no substance.
Okay, that gives us a really solid understanding of the word. So putting it all together, how does one actually break this commandment? The source highlights three main ways. Let's start with blasphemy.
Right, blasphemy. In both Hebrew and Greek, the core idea is to slander, to injure the reputation, to deliberately insult.
Okay, now, and that can happen how?
Two main ways. You could literally use the divine name, Yahweh, itself, in an insulting or contemptuous way.
Which seems to be what happened in that really stark story in Leviticus 24.
Exactly. Leviticus 24.2. This man, son of an Israelite woman and an Egyptian father, gets into a fight and he blasphemed the name and cursed.
The name with a capital N meaning Yahweh.
That's how the Jewish tradition, the Mishnah, interprets it. He specifically uttered the actual covenant name in a blasphemous way.
Yeah.
And the consequence was severe stoning by the whole community. It shows just how seriously they took a direct verbal assault on God's honor.
Wow. Okay. But you said there's a second way to blaspheme.
Yes. And perhaps more common is speaking evil about God, slandering his reputation, his character.
Ah, linking back to name meaning reputation.
Exactly. Look at Psalm 139. The psalmist talks about enemies who take your name in vain using our commandments language.
Oh.
What does he equate that with? Speaking against you with malicious intent.
So taking the name in vain there is speaking against God's reputation.
Clearly. It's about undermining God's character. And, you know, this might shed light on why Jesus was condemned. He was accused of blasphemy. Why?
Because he claimed to be God. Or equal with God.
Essentially, yes. By identifying himself with God, particularly using titles like the Son of Man from Daniel, which implies divine authority, his accusers saw it as him making himself equal with God, thereby, in their view, slandering God's unique status and reputation.
It's twisting the idea of who God is.
In their minds, absolutely. And related to this is that concept people worry about blasphemy against the Holy Spirit.
The unforgivable sin. What's the understanding there? Is it saying a specific bad word?
No, it seems much deeper than that. Jesus talks about it in the context of people seeing clear evidence of God's work through the Spirit, his healings, his power, and deliberately attributing it to Satan.
What?
It's not about an accidental slip of the tongue. It seems to be about a settled, hardened heart, a persistent, stubborn refusal to acknowledge God's work when it's right in front of you, choosing instead to slander the very source of that work. It's an attitude of profound rejection, not just a single act.
Okay, that context is helpful, but still, the punishments, like stoning,
it
makes God seem, I don't know, easily offended, like he has a fragile ego.
That's a really understandable modern reaction, but we have to see it through their lens. For ancient Israel, God wasn't just a deity. He was their king, their covenant partner, the source of their national existence and well-being.
Okay.
So, speaking evil against him, undermining trust in his character, his promises, his ability to save, that wasn't just rude. It was seen as treason.
Treason. Ah.
Yeah, it threatened the entire community's relationship with God, their stability, their identity, protecting God's name. His reputation was about protecting the foundation of their society and their faith. It wasn't about divine ego. It was about covenant loyalty and survival.
That reframes it completely. Okay, second way to break the commandment, false oaths and broken vows.
Right. Now, interestingly, Israelites were actually encouraged sometimes to swear oaths in the name of the Lord. Deuteronomy 6.3 says, "Fear the Lord your God and swear by his name."
So swearing by God wasn't the problem.
No, the idea was, if you're going to swear by the true God, not by, you know, Baal or the stars or some other false deity, which was common pagan practice. Ground your oath in ultimate reality.
Okay, so what's the violation then?
The violation is swearing falsely by his name. Leviticus 19.12 puts it plainly. "You shall not swear by my name falsely, and so profane the name of the Lord your God."
Profane meaning to make common or treat as unholy.
Exactly. So imagine saying, "I swear to God I'll pay you back on Tuesday," but you have absolutely zero intention of doing it. Or maybe you don't even have the money.
You're just using God's name to sound convincing.
Precisely. To manipulate, to add weight to your lie. It shows, as the source says, a total lack of respect, total lack of fear for the Lord. You're treating God's name, his reputation for truthfulness, as empty shva.
And there are consequences mentioned for this too, right, in Zechariah.
Oh, yeah. Zechariah 5 talks about a curse going out over the land against thieves and those who swear falsely by God's name. It says they'll be cleansed out, their houses consumed. Pretty dramatic imagery.
Definitely. So how does Jesus address this? He talks about oaths in the Sermon on the Mount.
He does, and it's radical.
Yeah.
He basically says don't take any oath at all.
At all. Why?
His point seems to be that if you are a person of genuine integrity, someone whose character reflects God's kingdom, you shouldn't need an oath to be believed. Your simple yes should be reliable enough to mean yes, and your no should mean no.
Anything more comes from a lack of integrity or from the evil one.
Something like that. If your word isn't good enough on its own, adding an oath doesn't magically fix your character. And he clarifies, you know, don't swear by heaven because that's God's throne.
Or by earth, his footstool.
Right, or Jerusalem. These are all connected to God. It's called metonymy, using a related concept to stand for the main thing. Swearing by heaven is essentially invoking God.
So just be straightforward, be trustworthy.
Exactly. James, Jesus' brother, echoes this later in his letter, James 5.12. "Above all, my brothers, do not swear, either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, so that you may not fall under condemnation." Oaths become dangerous territory if your word isn't already solid.
Okay, that makes sense. Now the third way. This one feels distinctly ancient, using God's name in magic spells.
Yeah, this one might seem a bit out there for us today, but it was a real concern back then.
Because names held power could be used to control.
That was the belief in the magical worldview. Absolutely. Remember, names were seen as extensions of the person or the spirit. So magicians thought if they could get hold of the right name, especially powerful deity's name, they could invoke it in spells to compel that spirit to do their bidding.
Like trying to force God's hand.
Exactly. Trying to manipulate divine power. Yeah. We hear theories like the word abracadabra or something. It might be a garbled version of an Aramaic phrase invoking the Trinity, like Obra, Father, Bar, Son. Cat, Holy, Abro, Spirit.
Wow, really? That's wild.
It's a theory. But it shows how names could get mixed up in these magical formulas. We also have physical evidence, like execration texts or bowls.
What are those?
People would write the name of an enemy on a piece of pottery, maybe add a curse, invoking a deity's name, calling on that deity to harm the enemy, and then they'd smash the bowl.
Sympathetic magic. Break the bowl. Break the enemy.
Right. It's described as a kind of perverse parody of prayer. Instead of humbly asking God, you're trying to command or use divine power for your own, often malicious, ends. It's utterly disrespectful.
And it connects back to Jesus' warning against meaningless repetitions like the pagans use in prayer.
It does. It's treating the divine name as a tool, a formula, rather than representing a relationship requiring reverence. And here's a kicker. Apparently, the name Yahweh, despite Jewish efforts to protect it, was the most frequently invoked divine name found in Roman-era magic texts across the Mediterranean.
No way. Why?
Probably because it was seen as this mysterious, potent name of the powerful, unseen God of the Jews. Foreign magicians thought it must hold some kind of secret superpower they could tap into.
So ironic. They completely missed the point of the reverence.
Completely. They wanted to use the power without the relationship or the respect.
Okay, so we've got these three ancient ways. Direct blasphemy, insulting the name or reputation, false oaths, using the name deceptively, and magic, trying to manipulate God through the name. How do these translate to today? Are they still relevant?
Oh, absolutely. The forms might change slightly, but the underlying issues are definitely still with us.
How so? Let's take blasphemy first.
Well, you still see direct, open mockery of God, of Jesus, of Christian faith. Maybe not punishable by stoning in most societies today. Right. But even if it comes from outside the believing community, that kind of slander can still wound people's faith, discourage those who are struggling, and, frankly, be pretty effective at undermining respect for God in the wider culture. It still damages the name or reputation.
And false oaths. That seems pretty timeless.
Totally. You mentioned politicians earlier invoking God's name to sound pious or sincere about promises they may have no real intention of keeping. God bless America, tacked onto a speech that's anything but godly in its substance.
Right, using it as a political tool.
Exactly. Or think about that example from counseling. The couple where both husband and wife are swearing to God that their totally contradictory stories are true.
Using God's name to try and win the argument or appear more credible?
Yeah, it's using God's name in an utterly empty way, shva, purely for personal gain, to manipulate the situation. It's still happening all the time.
Okay. So that brings us to the third one, using God's name like magic for selfish ends. The source suggests this might be the most prominent violation today. How does that work now?
This is where it gets really subtle and maybe hits closer to home for many of us. It's about co-opting God for our purposes.
Okay. Explain that.
Think historically, like the Crusades. You had lords, even clergy, driven by greed for land and power, but they wrapped it all up in piety.
God wills it.
Exactly. Invoking God's name to justify violence and conquest that serve their own ambitions. They weren't seeking God's will. They were using his name to validate their will. That's trying to use God's name like a magic wand to get what you want.
And contemporary examples, where do we see that now?
Well, you still see politicians who build careers by appealing to religious voters, sometimes seemingly without deep personal conviction. Or, more cynically, people trying to build ministries focused primarily on generating wealth, using God's name as a brand for profit.
The depths of cynicism, as the source put it.
Right. But it can be much more mundane, too. Think about disagreements within a church or organization.
Uh-oh.
How often does someone attach God's name to their personal preference? I really feel God wants us to keep this old building, when maybe it's just nostalgia, or the Lord is leading us to start this new program, when it's really just their pet project. Or even something trivial, God wants us to boycott carrots.
Okay, maybe not carrots, but I see the point. Taking my agenda, my opinion, my desire, and stamping approved by God on it.
That's exactly it. It fundamentally boils down to a lack of humility. Instead of asking God, what are your ends and how can I serve them? We ask God, how can I get you to serve my ends?
It's trying to employ God rather than be employed by him.
Precisely. It's that subtle modern version of trying to use the name, the divine authority, like a magic spell to achieve what we want.
Wow. Okay, so wrapping this up for you, the listener, the big takeaway here seems to be that this third commandment goes way beyond just, you know, not using certain four-letter words.
Oh, much deeper. It's fundamentally about reverence, yes, but also about humility. It's about recognizing God's true nature, who he is, his reputation, and not trying to twist it or use it for our own gain.
It's about understanding that God isn't ours to control or manipulate.
Right. Which leads to maybe a challenging question for all of us. How often, maybe even unconsciously, are we trying to enlist God in our plans, our causes, our preferences, instead of genuinely seeking to align ourselves with His?
Yeah, that really makes me think of C.S. Lewis and the Narnia books. Yeah. Mr. Beaver is explaining Aslan, the Christ figure, the great lion, to the children, and Lucy asks if Aslan is safe.
And Mr. Beaver says?
He says something like, "Safe? Who said anything about safe? Of course he isn't safe. But he's good. He's the king, I tell you." And later, I think he adds, "He is not a tame lion."
Not a tame lion.
Yeah. He doesn't serve us. We serve him.
That captures it perfectly, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That idea of trying to make God tame, trying to make him serve our agendas, that really is perhaps the most common, most insidious way we break this commandment today, both out of the world and maybe especially even within the church.
Trying to co-opt the untamable God for our own tame causes.
Exactly. Something profound to chew on.